You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. From the Vanities, timestamp. The name game. Irreverent text messages exchanged over many years take on a new meaning, by Sloane Crosley. In 2008, I was on the phone with my friend's younger brother when the news broke that Tim Russert had died. I didn't have much of a relationship with my friend's younger brother and can't remember why we were on the phone in the first place. Perhaps we were planning a surprise party. Perhaps an intervention. Perhaps both. "Oh, man," Jack interrupted himself. "Tim Russert just died." "For the rest of my life," I said, "you'll be the one who told me that." About a week later, Jack's name appeared on my screen, followed by the words George Carlin, Bernie Mac. I fired back. This is how the game began, innocently enough. This is also, somewhat miraculously, how it continued. For the past 12 years, every time a person of note has died, the two of us have raced to our phones. It is not the basis of our friendship. It is the entire friendship. Visualize, if you will, what this looks like. More than a decade's worth of two-word bubbles, staggered vertically like a video game ladder. We do not take joy in the deaths, nor do we fetishize or mourn them. We are simply transferring names from one list to another. There are exceptions, such as the time we simultaneously texted each other Michael Jackson and argued about it, or the time Jack wrote Carrie Fisher and I stopped short in the street and told him so. He didn't know how to respond. The text exchange is not built for pathos, for treating celebrities like people. Perhaps the most chilling was Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'd met Hoffman at a Christmas party where we shared a cigarette by an open window, and he told me about a running joke he had with a friend. Wanting to amuse him, I took out my phone. He scrolled through the text, using the fingers unoccupied by the cigarette, and laughed. A month later, I woke up to his name. 12 years is a long time for a text thread. Do we feel guilty about minimizing humanity for our own creepy amusement? It's not like we're selling it. We're not paparazzi. Ours is a macabre piece of performance art for two. Though I sometimes wonder if we've managed to teach ourselves anything about anonymity versus fame. Sure doesn't seem like it. The game's counterintuitive mix of laziness and competition mimics the feeling of being on Twitter, which is also not an educational tool. We've played with the form. Democracy, irony, disco, my youth, your youth. But really, it was just the names of recently deceased celebrities. Was. On March 11th, I decided to start from scratch with a tacit set of criteria. Tom Hanks, Rita Wilson, that's cheating, and we're off to the races. Life outside the exchange is a never-ending procession of heartbreaking realities and depressing scenarios. Jack lives in Los Angeles. I live in Manhattan. We are surrounded. Sirens moan as if trying to make a point, and we're not listening. Okay, they say, maybe a little louder then. Doors that were once closed in caution remain propped open in caution. At minimum, the world has learned it's possible to be homesick for the exact place in which you're trapped. But by the time this year is over, none of us will have gotten away with at minimum. In the meantime, we're told it's helpful to maintain patterns, to develop hobbies. Some people make sourdough starters. Some do jigsaw puzzles. Jack and I do this. Except something is off. No longer an empty ceremony. The new names do not vanish from our minds after we press send. The sick are somehow worse than the dead because they are inseparable from our daily thoughts. We were, in some abstract way, already thinking about them. We're all hooked up to the same illness mainframe. Many of these people will recover, or already have, but each name represents more than itself, thereby shedding its expensively perfumed skin. We only know they're sick because of their access to testing, money, and media, but we cannot help but extrapolate percentages. This is part of the newfound utility of our enterprise. Right now, the days are bleeding together, but in the future, I will have my memory jogged by timestamps. I will note the rash of political figures, Sophie Trudeau, Boris Johnson, probably Bolsonaro, who comprised the first wave. This iteration also unearths personal questions for the first time. What will we do when it's one of the people we know in common? When it's a parent? What will we do when one of us texts the other me? I don't know. I know we are trying to outsmart our trauma by throwing a familiar stick at it, but the trauma keeps returning, dropping more fancy names at our feet. Much has been made of the rickety nature of celebrity culture in this moment, the mascot of which has become Gal Gadot's faux-spirational Imagine video, also known as the pop equivalent of Trump's CEO-laden address to a shaken nation. This is the kind of thing that deserves to be filleted so long as we have the energy. But the mass celebrity berating also reminds me of a question with which we used to concern ourselves. What should be done with the children of famous actors? Should these talented youngsters be denied because of their parents? If the answer to this type of question before was kinda, the answer now is oh, definitely. The rules are clear. Civilians get to telegraph whatever nonsense makes us feel better in the face of disaster, because we already have a citizen's arrest-style system in place for peer-to-peer self-promotion. Famous rich people have had their right to this indulgence revoked. Maybe that's not fair. They, too, are experiencing a sense of dread that must feel very real to them. But the smart ones are staying quiet, or at least avoiding wide shots of the lawn. The text exchange slips through all that. It provides Jack and me with a customary hit of frivolity while being recused from the celebrity conversation. Even though it is only about famous people, we offer no commentary. Their driver's licenses are more salacious. We don't care what they do. During this horrible time that none of us can yet name, is it an age, an epoch, a year of? Celebrities are closer to being faceless statistics than they've ever been. To some, this clearly smacks of demotion. Perhaps it is. But what I do know is that a game that used to make them less human now makes them more so. In 2 decades of New York life, I have personally witnessed a citywide mind meld only 3 times. These are days when every disparate pair of eyes has the same set of thoughts behind them. The first was after 9/11. The second was after Obama won. And the third was after Hillary lost. Giddy or devastated, each instance was a rare phenomenon. This is the fourth. And what I wouldn't give for a little ignorance about what my neighbors are thinking. We are all grasping for familiarity, For context, the virus is like the Berlin Wall, erected quickly and separating or imprisoning families. The virus is like Vesuvius over Pompeii, petrifying our lives wherever they stood. The virus is like nothing. It is like nothing we think we know, this plague on our modern world. We have no comparisons. And yet, superficial as it may be, we still have these famous faces milling about their gleaming kitchens. Idris Elba, Jack writes me as I write this. This is how we will keep track, I think, in this virtual space that, like so many spaces, has been repurposed for an emergency. As I scroll through the text exchange, I am reminded of a line from a dark short story called River of Names by Dorothy Allison. We were so many, we were without number, and like tadpoles, if there was one less from time to time, who counted? Who counted? Our game may be glib, but we are counting. Governments may minimize the statistics, but we are counting. We are staring at the smooth marble of a massive family headstone, meeting our reflection in the blank space. We know that a text exchange is no memorial. Repurposing has its limits. But what it does have going for it is all the room in the world. As many names as you like, as many names as you know, until one very fine day when we can start over.
Thank you.
This is the June 2020 cover story, Artist in Residence. Janelle Monáe's upcoming performances, the starring role in the series Homecoming, and a woman ripped out of time in the summer movie Antebellum, are perfectly pitched for our unsettled moment. The 8-time Grammy nominee, style icon, and Prince protege speaks to Vanity Fair from quarantine about fear, fury, and hope, by Johanna Desta. Photographs by Collier Shore, styled by Samira Nasser. Janelle Monáe's voice flows like a sound bath calibrated to induce hypnosis. "You're in my imagination," she says. "I have just asked where she is geographically. I had to, because she's using a digital background that sets her floating above the Golden Gate Bridge, hovering near the slope of one of its spindly tentacles, surrounded by water on all sides. But Monáe takes my question and knocks it on its side. It's not about where she is, it's about where she's decided to take me. It's a mid-April day. Monáe and I are, of course, talking to each other over Zoom, the video chat platform that became indispensable when the coronavirus began its rampage. On top of being an 8-time Grammy nominee who can sing, rap, dance, and play piano and guitar, as well as act, with tremendous ease, Monáe is built for an era in which technology facilitates humanity. She is a disciple of the classic 1927 sci-fi movie Metropolis. She spent years crafting concept albums about apocalyptic robots and black, queer, Afro-futuristic revolution, often performing as her android alter ego, Cindy Mayweather. Alongside frequent collaborators Chuck Lightning and Nate Wonder, she's also the co-founder of an arts collective called the Wonderland Arts Society, whose manifesto includes lofty lines about how songs are like spaceships, books are like stars, and music is a weapon of the future. Monáe's nascent acting career, she debuted in 2016 with side-by-side turns in the movies Moonlight and Hidden Figures, tilts toward conspiracy and dystopia these days. She's just taken over the lead of Homecoming, the Amazon Prime thriller, now in its second unnerving season, which dives deeper into the mystery of the secret facility conducting dark experiments on war vets. She will also star in Antebellum, a blood-curdling, time-twisting horror film about slavery that's due in theaters August 21st. The rest of us are still unpacking what it means to live in a state of unreality. Janelle Monáe has been expecting it. So, at the time of our conversation, Monáe is somewhere. She's in a room, definitely, her arms outstretched in front of her on a table. Her skin is glowing, despite the fact that she's still recovering from a bout of mercury poisoning diagnosed last year. Monáe is one of those rare people with perfectly symmetrical features, a possessor of almost algorithmic beauty. She is wearing a white jumpsuit from a Japanese brand she can't remember, topped with a quilted white Ruslan Baginski Baker Boy cap, and a bandana from an Atlanta thrift store tied around her neck. She stands up to show me the full look, so petite that she is never in any danger of escaping the frame. "She has so much vibrance and she's no bigger than a minute," says Julia Roberts, who starred in the first season of Homecoming and who, as an executive producer, personally approved Monáe's casting. "When I walk up to her, I feel like I've just come out of the giant women forest." Monáe doesn't want to share where she is, partly because the place you're sheltering becomes exponentially more important when you're going to be there indefinitely. Besides, this gives her a chance to raise her reputation as a deeply private person to the level of performance art. When I ask her to describe the things around her, she pauses and looks around for a moment. What comes next sounds like disassembled Bjork lyrics. "I have an orange," she starts, after careful, Cheshire Cat-like consideration. "I have a pineapple, I have a notebook, and I have a hammer." Artful obfuscation is part of Monet's appeal. She is, after all, a performer who counted Prince among her mentors. Monet, who's 34, has protected her mystique from the beginning of her career, even when she was an unknown, singing on the steps of Atlanta College libraries for free, before Diddy signed her to a remarkably hands-off deal with Bad Boy Records in 2008 and jump-started her mainstream career. Monet's place in our culture is singular. She's a hybrid soul-pop R&B singer with a signature black-and-white wardrobe, fusing a fondness for old-school pompadours and funky James Brown dance moves. With Octavia Butler-style sci-fi narratives and futuristic terrains. As she proclaimed when she opened the Oscars this year with a splashy musical number, she's also black and queer. In another era, she might not have been able to exist in the public sphere at all. In the photos, all dressed up, Janelle Monáe and Collier Shore, who shot her from thousands of miles away. "No one stands in the fullness of their power quite like Janelle Monáe," says her friend, former First Lady Michelle Obama. "As an artist, she is constantly evolving. No matter what Janelle does, whether it's making music, acting, or producing, she approaches it all with grace, kindness, and an untouchable sense of style. She is an incandescent talent." Monáe, a warm Midwesterner at heart, was raised in Kansas City, Kansas, by Baptist working-class parents. Her mother, Janet, was a janitor and hotel maid, her father, Michael, a truck driver. Monáe is quick to ask me about my own family in self-isolation, sneaking multiple questions under the trench coat of a single burst. "How are you? How is your family? How are you guys coping? Are you by yourself or surrounded by people?" At one point, she happily takes off her cap to reveal fuzzy cornrows done by hairstylist Nikki Nelms before the pandemic. "Look at my hair," she chirps. "I've had the same braids for the last month and a half." For the record, here are the activities that have occupied Monáe's quarantine itinerary. Waking up at 5:30 a.m. to catch the sunrise, working on new music, hanging out with her self-isolation housemates, who have dubbed themselves the Quarantinagers, honing her DJing skills with mixes heavy on Stevie Wonder and Earth, Wind, and Fire, playing trivia games on House Party on her phone, and downloading Duolingo to learn French from scratch. Monáe's production company, Wonderland Pictures, signed a first-look deal with Universal in 2018, and, she explains, "I'm looking at a couple projects that deal with learning French." She is also, like millions of others, spending her days seething about Washington's response to the virus. "The way our government is handling things, especially this administration, is evil," she says. In this interview and many others, Monáe refuses to say the words Donald Trump. "We can't trust this administration to tell us the truth, to protect us. It's always going to be power first. It's always going to be capitalism first." Politically, Monáe's beliefs fall right in line with the ethos of Homecoming, which was created by Micah Bloomberg and Eli Horowitz, who adapted their Gimlet Media podcast of the same name. In its first season, directed by Mr. Robot's Sam Esmail, Homecoming revolved around a transitional support center that provided housing and counseling for military vets, all the while serving them drug-laced meals that would erase their traumatic wartime memories so they could be redeployed. Monet was already a fan of the series. When she read the new scripts, she was quick to say yes. "I could see a lot of great actors playing this role," she says of her character, which was written without a particular ethnicity attached. "But I love the fact that I am black and that I get to bring that to the table." In season two, which marks her first outing as a TV lead, Monet plays Jackie, a vet who wakes up in a canoe in the middle of a lake with no idea whatsoever of where or even who she is. Retracing her steps and crossing paths with shrewd Audrey, played by the brilliant Hong Chau, she begins to decipher the truth. To prepare for the role, Monet studied thrillers about memory loss like Memento and The Bourne Identity, as well as the dramatic turns of one of her favorite actors, Kerry Washington, whose nuance she finds aspirational. It turns out that Monet is an assured action star, gripping and magnetic. Once you round the corner on one of the new Homecoming season's biggest twist, you'll see her performance in a different light and rush back to the first episode for a rewatch. "I was really impressed with how nimble her performance is," says Roberts. "This kind of show is not for the faint of heart, and the workload is Herculean. I know that firsthand." Playing Jackie also gave Monet, who identifies as pansexual, her first opportunity to play a queer character. Monet declines to get specific about her own love life, which is rumored to have included famous and talented women, such as Tessa Thompson, whom Monet cast to play her lover in the accompanying film, or emotion picture in Wonderland parlance, for her last album, Dirty Computer. "When I ask how she's handling romance at the moment, she just laughs and says she can't wait until she can get a COVID test, until everyone can get a test and go forth and romance each other in good health. I don't want to disclose the people I'm dating or have dated. I may not always want this to be at the center of a conversation." Monet knows the power of representation, however, and was thrilled to play Jackie. "I feel a deeper responsibility because I know there are kids like me who could have come from conservative backgrounds," she says. Next photo, Piano Woman. Monet has been practicing while sheltering in place. Monet's social conscience led her to sign on for Antebellum too. She stars as Veronica Henley, a polished present-day author who, after speaking out about systemic racism, suddenly finds herself living as a slave on a plantation. Monet was drawn to the movie because she's a fan of Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained. One of her musical alter egos is the unapologetic Django Jane, and Antebellum wound up being shot at Louisiana's Evergreen Plantation, where parts of that movie were filmed. Monet also liked the way Antebellum evoked Octavia Butler's novel Kindred, and the fact that it put a woman at the center of a revenge narrative. Antebellum is unsparing in its violence, as well as in its view of race relations and the way they've evolved, or not, over the centuries. The movie may divide viewers, but Monet is transfixing. She channels Veronica's pain with true grit. "She really went inward," says Gerard Bush, who wrote and directed the movie with Christopher Renz. "It was an incredibly difficult experience for her. These plantations, where people are getting married, these are places that should be considered hallowed ground. It should be Auschwitz. You should walk this ground with that kind of respect for the suffering that took place on that land." She was committed to honoring the ancestors. Monet weighed the challenges of the part seriously before accepting it. "I knew that taking on this role was going to take a lot of deep diving emotionally," she says. "This role is the hardest role that I've done because it directly connects the past, present, and the future. I went back and forth with, should I do this? People are going to think I'm crazy. It wasn't until I did some deep meditation and I saw so many women that reminded me of Veronica, from Maxine Waters to AOC to all of the strong women in our government, that I said, yes, I should do this. This scares me, and the conversations need to be had because our past will directly determine our future. As for her own future, Monet wants to act even more, eager to get in on another set as soon as it's safe. For now, she's in problem-solving mode, figuring out how to support her family from a distance, including her stepdad, a longtime employee of the U.S. Postal Service, a government entity in desperate need that the Trump administration has thus far refused to bail out. Monet also has a collaborative team she needs to look after. That will be harder now that some of her biggest gigs, like this year's Essence Festival and NYC Pride, have been canceled. I've been trying to help the band and the crew as much as I can, she says. I've been trying. I'll have to figure out different ways to financially support myself. There was a moment where I did break down and cry, not just for myself, but for everybody this is affecting, everybody who's going to lose somebody. Dismayed by the government's paltry $1,200 stimulus checks, Monet has launched a slew of philanthropic efforts through the Wonderland Arts Society in Atlanta. She's partnered with Verizon to donate money to Black and LGBTQ plus owned local businesses. And since 2018, she served as a co-chair of When We All Vote, a voting registration nonprofit started by Michelle Obama. I've been doing a lot of organizing because we are not all in the same boat, she says. Staying at home for me is different than staying at home and not working for a mom with five kids when she's single and can't afford to pay her rent or pay for food for her kids. Monet is tireless when it comes to talking politics. She can, and frequently does, bring every topic back around to governance, to capitalism, to corporate greed, to giving the power back to the people. Her polymathic approach to art extends beyond recording studios and film sets. It's in her philanthropy, in her activism, in everything she does. As an activist, she uses her platform to lift up countless communities, says Obama. I've seen her inspire young people across this country to step into their own power and make their voices heard at the ballot box. Next photo, Janelle Monae walks down a garden path. Because I can't meet Monae in person, I ask her friends to tell me how they first met her. Their stories illustrate two of the best ways you could ever meet anyone and capture Monet in different modes. Erykah Badu met Monet after she invited the singer to tour with her in 2010. The first place I took Janelle and her crew was Sedona, Arizona, so that we could visit a vortex, she says. The Sedona vortexes, which until now I did not know existed, are swirling centers of energy that are conducive to healing, meditation, and self-exploration, per the town's tourism board. Real cosmic shit. Nobody smoked or drank, says Badu. We were just all really sober-minded and clear and pure. Everybody puts their guards down because you feel so balanced. She and Monet bonded fast. We're mirror reflections of one another when it comes to the way we create. That's my twin. Billy Porter met Monet under much more glamorous circumstances when she asked him to perform with her at the Oscars earlier this year. In retrospect, the Emmy and Tony-winning Porter was a perfect duet partner, but he says Monet had to fight for him. There were different suggestions, and she said, I'll only do it if I can have Billy, he recalls. She lobbied for me. Later, they celebrated over cocktails at Beyoncé and Jay-Z's Oscar party. A group outing to a vortex, a packed soiree. They're relics from before civilization was turned upside down. During isolation, Monet has been thinking about her devotion to privacy and why she finds it so difficult to talk about the people she's fallen in love with, or even the very room she's sitting in for this conversation. Her mind has been turning up old traumas, particularly her relationship with her father. They're close now, she says, but when she was growing up, her dad was battling a crack addiction and served time in prison. I'm happy that he has recovered, but what that left me with growing up was having abandonment issues, because I just never knew when he would show up. I have high anxiety. I've always had it. She remembers when she and her friends would throw parties in 8th or 9th grade and charge people $2 to get in. Before the parties, Monet locked herself in the bathroom. I was just like, they're not going to show up. Nobody's going to come. That feeling seeped into her career and affected how much she reveals about her private life. If I really talked openly and honestly about where I am right now, would I be abandoned? Would my fans abandon me? Would my family abandon me? She's been trying to unpack those feelings and memories by keeping a journal and writing music centered around what it means to deal with your trauma. How does that sound? How does that feel? What are the colors there? I talked to Monet a second time a few days after our Zoom chat. She's wrapped the photo shoot for this issue and mentions that she kept the braids for the pictures. I loved it because it was just a reflection of where I am now, she says. The worst of her mercury poisoning symptoms, the fatigue, the hair loss, the breakouts, are behind her, fortunately. Monet has spent some time driving around lately, observing people in mask, taking in the state of our world. She's also been reflecting on something her friend Melody Hobson, the investment executive and former DreamWorks animation chairwoman, told her. Monet performed at Hobson's 2013 wedding to George Lucas. What Hobson said in essence was this: we got through the Spanish flu, and we'll get through this. There will be a vaccine and a future. There can be a real uprising, Monet says, of society post-pandemic. The majority of us do not want to continue to see things be the way that they are. We're demanding better health care for ourselves, demanding people listen to scientists as it pertains to the environment, as it pertains to our health. Still, at this point in her self-isolation journey, Monet is ready to have just a few simple pleasures back. She wants to hug her mom. She wants to hug her sister and her infant niece. She wants to travel to South Africa. She wants to really live again, and more. Above all, she wants to be in a room full of people, music pulsing as they stand too close and move too much. I'm ready to go to a party, she says insistently. A party where we are sweating, we are smiling, we are dancing for our souls. in the shallows. Before he was for opening the beaches, Donald Trump was for closing them. Before he punted responsibility to governors, he asserted absolute authority. And this was all supposed to be over in March. Gabriel Sherman reports on the head-snapping contradictions of the president in the time of crisis. Opening photo shows a packed beach. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a close Trump ally in a crucial swing state, wanted to keep beaches open, and Trump bowed to pressure. On the afternoon of Thursday, March 19th, Donald Trump sat in the Oval Office obsessing over the beaches in Florida. CNN footage of shirtless spring breakers packed onto the sand while the coronavirus pandemic raged sparked national outrage and pressure on Trump to act. The next morning, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo would announce strict stay-at-home orders for residents, but Florida's Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, refused to close his state's beaches, a position even Florida's Republican Senator Rick Scott called reckless. Lots of people were telling Trump to lean on Ron, a Trump advisor said. Trump's view of the situation was complicated, though. For weeks, his top medical advisors, Dr. Deborah Birx and Dr. Anthony Fauci, had been hectoring him about the seriousness of the crisis and the necessity of swift action, testing, lockdowns. We knew from the beginning we were going to get cases in the United States, Fauci told me. We knew we were in for a very serious problem. Sometimes Trump listened. The disease was coming closer to his own circle. Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and Communications Director Stephanie Grisham were self-quarantining, and the number of cases in New York City had reached 4,000. But the substrate of his thinking hadn't evolved, and it kept reappearing. He worried about the economy, which was crucial to his reelection. He vented to friends that the doctors were alarmist, and that the crisis was something Democrats and the media were doing to him. Trump was obsessed with Pelosi, Schiff, the media, just obsessed. He would say, "They're using it against me," recalled a Republican in frequent contact with the White House. It was unhinged. Florida was a test case of his magical thinking about the novel coronavirus, that it was temporary, that warm weather would make it disappear. But 8 Florida residents had already died from COVID-19, and more than 400 had been diagnosed. Given the elderly population, if that took off, it would be a nightmare, a person close to Trump told me. At an advisor's urging, Trump called DeSantis to tell him to shut down the beaches. "Ron, what are you doing down there?" Trump said, according to a person briefed on the call. "I can't ban people from going on the beach," DeSantis snapped, surprising Trump. "These pictures look really bad to the rest of the country," Trump said. "Listen, we're doing it the right way," DeSantis said. DeSantis's intransigence backed Trump into a corner. The 41-year-old governor was a Trump protege and a crucial ally in a must-win state. "Trump is worried about Florida electorally," said a Republican who spoke with Trump around this time. Trump did something he rarely does. He caved. He told DeSantis the beaches could stay open. "I understand what you're saying," Trump said, and hung up. It was inevitable that Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar would become the West Wing COVID-19 scapegoat. An avuncular Yale-educated lawyer with owlish glasses and a beard, Azar was not, as Trump liked to say, out of central casting. Equally bad, Azar was a Bushy, as Trump called Republicans who served in George W. Bush's administration. Azar was briefed on a new and dangerous coronavirus sweeping the Chinese city of Wuhan by CDC Director Robert Redfield on January 3rd. but he struggled to communicate this knowledge to the president. At the time of the outbreak, Trump had soured on Azar, whom he blamed for his weak health care polling numbers. Trump thought Azar was a disaster. He is definitely on the gangplank, a person close to Trump told me. Azar wasn't able to speak to Trump about the virus for 2 weeks. Even though Trump called him during this period to scream that the White House's ban on e-cigarettes, a response to a health crisis that he believed could help him politically, had become a drag on his poll numbers. I never should have done this effing vaping thing, Trump told Azar on January 17th, according to a person familiar with the call. When Azar finally told Trump about the outbreak, after reaching him by phone at Mar-a-Lago on the night of Saturday, January 18th, Trump cut him off and launched into another e-cigarette rant. Trump jumped his shit about vaping, a person briefed on the phone call told me. Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, shared Trump's view that the media and Democrats were hyping the crisis for political purposes. And for both of them, the biggest worry was how the response to the coronavirus might impact the health of the economy. According to sources, White House trade advisor Peter Navarro, a fierce China hawk, and Deputy National Security Advisor Matt Pottinger, a former China-based Wall Street Journal reporter who covered the 2003 SARS pandemic, argued to officials in mid-January that the White House needed to shut down incoming flights from China. Kushner pushed back. Jared kept saying the stock market would go down and Trump wouldn't get reelected. A Republican briefed on the internal debates said, a person close to Kushner denies this. Kushner's position was supported by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and National Economic Council Chief Larry Kudlow. Trump sided with them. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Trump minimized the threat in his first public comments. It's one person coming in from China, and we have it under control, he told CNBC. The White House and Treasury Department deny Mnuchin and Kudlow were against closing flights. When the coronavirus exploded out of China, Kushner was the second most powerful person in the West Wing, exerting influence over virtually every significant decision, from negotiating trade deals to 2020 campaign strategy to overseeing Trump's impeachment defense. Jared is running everything. He's the de facto president of the United States, a former White House official told me. The previous chief of staff, John Kelly, who'd marginalized Kushner, was long gone, and Mick Mulvaney, a virtual lame duck by that point, let Kushner run free. Jared treats Mick like the help, a prominent Republican said. Kushner's princely arrogance had been a fixture in the West Wing since Trump's inauguration. The family has a degree of trust and protection that no one else enjoys, the former West Wing official said. Kushner can appear mild-mannered, but like his father-in-law, he seemed to relish the power he derived from crushing adversaries. After Trump's acquittal, Kushner helped orchestrate a purge of national security officials who testified against the president. According to a source, Kushner provided the White House's 29-year-old personnel director, John McEntee, with a list of names to be fired. In no way, shape, or form did Jared provide a list to Johnny McEntee on people to be fired, a source familiar with the matter said. During his time in the West Wing, Kushner had become hardened to a degree that was sometimes shocking. The days of selling the notion that he and Ivanka were moderating forces were long gone. Combat was everything. A New York business executive recalled a meeting with Kushner at the White House last fall. I told Jared that if Trump won a second term, he wouldn't have to worry about running again, and you can really help people. Jared looked at me and said, I don't care about any of that. The executive came away shaken. I wanted to tell Jared, you don't say that part out loud, even in private, he later said. A source close to Kushner says he has no recollection of making the comment. Kushner had an enemies list as long as Trump's, and at times it played into his response to the crisis. He scoffed when his old nemesis Steve Bannon launched a podcast called War Room Pandemic in January. Steve's a dead man. Last he was seen, he was standing on the side of the FDR drive with the squeegee guys, Kushner told a Republican around this time. Kushner also had a famously unshakable belief in his own judgment. According to sources, Trump's former Homeland Security advisor Tom Bossert told Kushner in early March that the White House needed to step up its coronavirus response. Tom tried sounding the alarm with Jared, said a person who spoke to Bossert at the time. Bossert denies this. Kushner, according to the person, dismissed Bossert's concerns. Bossert later published his advice in a Washington Post op-ed. Tom was hammering him, "You have to get on this." No one listened, so he wrote this op-ed, a former West Wing official said. Bossert later told people that Kushner icily told him the op-ed was a mistake. Bossert denies this. Navarro and Pottinger finally convinced Trump to stop the flights when they showed him that more than 400,000 people had entered the U.S. from China since early January. Trump was stunned by the sheer scale, a Republican briefed on the meeting told me. Navarro banged on the table enough to get the flight stopped. On January 31st, Trump barred travel from China. Even then, it was a half measure. The ban applied only to non-Americans who had traveled to China in the previous 14 days. American citizens could come and go. Trump saw this as the end of the story. He'd taken strong public action, built his China wall. Now he looked forward to hitting the campaign trail and trumpeting the booming stock market. He just wanted to hold rallies and watch television, a former West Wing official said. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service, now known as North Carolina Reading Service, and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.